Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the Ladies Night In. We have a special guest in studio with us today, Mr. Robert Renteria. He is an amazing person.
Thank you.
And a realtor here in the Boise area. Been with Keller Williams for 22 years?
Yep.
Awesome, awesome. He also has a history in law enforcement, and he's got a lot of fun stories to tell. So we are excited to have you in studio.
Yes, and we're sending best wishes of healing to our
co-host.
Our co-host, Miss Elise. She's not feeling well.
She got the sniffles.
She's got a cold.
Plus.
So, yeah.
Yes.
We're going to miss her today, but she is with us in spirit. So.
Yes. So, okay. I want to kick off today's episode with just a couple questions. Where you are a realtor in the community, obviously there's a hype in the Boise area and the market is off the charts. Give a quick rundown. What's going on?
This is not just an Idaho problem. This is a challenge. It's a challenge. So I have tons and hundreds of realtor connections across the country. I coach nationally. And so everything that I'm telling you is something that somebody else in every town in America is going through. Here in Idaho, it's specifically higher because we have so many people coming from
California,
among others. Yes,
Washington.
Yes, keep going. Yes, that like to come here because of the conservative nature of Idaho.
Right,
I think that's nice way to put it, but and it still is a real value to other places, and I know it's causing problems here at home with other people, but I am finding solutions, like you know of specifically, that to connect people with other people to have success stories for both sides.
So one question: who do you think is having a harder time with this, the people that are filtering in to our community or the natives?
The people that don't have a good realtor. That's who.
Robert Renteria, Keller Williams.
No kidding. I'm just not even joking. We're not all created equal. We don't have the same work ethic. We don't have the same knowledge. We don't have the same philosophy about dealing with clients. So find a good one and pick their brain.
So what's the key to that? I mean, you can speak for yourself, but if someone, if like myself, what did I tell you? I said, hey, in this buying process, this is the first time for me.
Mm-hmm.
Hold my hand.
Mm-hmm.
Just do everything right because I don't know your language, but I'm trusting you.
Right.
So somebody that has their checklist, what should they look for?
Look for somebody that has a resume, that knows what they're doing. It's probably a student of the game. When I say student of the game, understand some financing. Understand the way some housing markets are working, other housing markets, understand solutions. They have to be solution-based and learning-based because we learn from others. So as I find a new technique or a new line or script or something that is going to benefit my client, I put another feather in my cap and I use it when it's appropriate.
And you do a lot of continuing ed, don't you?
I do.
That level of learning that you keep climbing.
Yeah. And, you know, just because somebody goes to school doesn't mean they know what they're doing.
Exactly.
So I practice.
Okay. I love it. Well, I am one of his clients and friend.
Thank you.
I think we bonded over my third piece of cheesecake.
This girl can eat, that's for sure.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, I can.
Well, and you know Elise as well.
Okay? I know Elise. I grew up
6 degrees of separation. So she was like, wait a minute. So she was super bummed to miss you today.
Do you want to tell her the whole dance story? Because she's a dancer too.
Oh my gracious.
Okay. So a little embarrassing story. When I was a freshman, Elise was a senior.
Okay.
And she was on a dance team and a cheerleader and all the bubbly things. And they went to all these boy athletes and they were like, hey, do you guys want to be with the dance team to do some sort of dance? I can't remember.
Yeah, usually a dance partner competition. Thing. Yeah.
So I'm like, okay. And so I did it, and Elise was on the team, and you know, small town, so we all knew each other anyway. Yeah. But I think I did it 2 or 3 years.
Good for you.
Maybe all the way through my senior year. I can't remember. Just one dance, and every year it changed, and it was like usually the same guys. And
oh yeah, that's awesome.
It was kind of fun. Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Very cool. Okay, just looking at you, I don't see you as a dancer.
Boy's got skills. Don't you doubt him?
It was fun.
I'm not doubting the skills.
I've worn a few hats in my time.
His cheeks are a little bit pink right now. Just a little rosy. It's cute.
So before we got this whole thing started, we were talking about topics that we wanted to talk about, kind of backgrounds of all of us. And at the Ladies' Night In, we obviously raise a glass to the good, the bad, and the ugly. But we also, when we get together, like to talk about like real life, things that have formed us into the people that we are today. So the three of us, we are all a product of addiction. I was not personally addicted to anything, but I watched a loved one right to the grave with addiction. And I think we all have a story on that and how it has impacted our lives. I know that it didn't just impact my life, it impacted my children's life. And I've had to pick those pieces up. And so today, let's discuss that. Where did we come from? How did we become better people? How do we educate people on that? So I'm going to kick it off, Shannon, first, because she's got a story.
I'll be cautious so as not to put anybody at risk with their anonymity or anything like that. But obviously some of, this revolves around my family. Dealing with family members, addicted to drugs started when I was about 11 years old. A family member had a best friend the mom was a dealer. So I was in drug dealers' homes from the age of 11. This gives me anxiety as I talk about it. I'm good. So it was in my home. I was witness to it. I'm so grateful that I had a very healthy fear of what was being used, the chemicals that were being put into the body. I thought, wow, I just don't understand how you would just pick up that chemical and be okay and feel safe to put that in your body. It just terrified me. So as a result of, with the two family members in my home that were using these methamphetamine at the time, they were not very available to me. I was very young. I was alone a lot. I was fearful a lot, pretty much raising myself there for a while. So that formed me into the person that I am. I do believe that I'm a bit hardened and at times, and I take care of the people around me, but I think that's because I wasn't altogether cared for that well after the age of 10, until I was older. So, in a certain sense, that builds your character, right? That you can take care of yourself. The journey with that continued in my family. I should just say, so it was my sister and my mom. It's hard to just, to dance around it. I've been through AA with both of them. So my mom and my dad divorced when I was 10. And my mom started, using some of these methamphetamines as well as my sister. And I watched them through this for many years. It continued on with my sister until just recently. So I think the last few years we're still dealing with the ramifications of addiction. And so as a family member going through this, there's not only, as a child you're neglected, right? Because you're definitely on the back burner. So you're raising yourself. And so there's a lot of loneliness with that and a lot of fear and instability. It's a family disease. And so it doesn't just affect the person who's using, it affects everyone around them. I know with my sister, just helping her get in and out of rehab. And you can't just sit back and do nothing. So you're involved and you're taking your personal time to help them with their finances or help make sure their bills are being paid if they're not in their home, if they're in rehab. You're calling rehab facilities. And plus the fear of losing them. I've almost lost them both, twice with my mom and once with my sister. So there's always this fear. And then there's a lot of anger that goes along with that. So I was blessed to go through a system, or it's a program. Her program was phenomenal, so I would suggest that if...
Is it still running?
No, she's retired. If you can get your family into a really good program. Like if you have a family member or a friend that's struggling, it's hard to get them to go into a program. That's not what they want to do. They're very.
How do you get them to go into a program?
Well, with my sister, it was a court mandated situation. my mother almost died. She OD'd. So I cleaned her up and said, let's get you in a program. And luckily she did it. She was very angry for a long time. It took her a long time to accept help, and it took her a long time to work the steps and to actually, I don't think I saw them put into action until about 3 years after she was done with her program. A lot of denial. So it took a long time to get that true amends from her. But
you probably go into like a like kind of a protective mode, almost like a, I hate to say a PTSD, but there's probably a trigger that trips. Mm-hmm. If something comes up with one of them where you go into, let me do this, let me do that, and almost checklist mode.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's been there, done that, right? So, but at the same time, I get angry because I don't want to deal with it. I have my own stuff. I have my own family to deal with. I don't want to pick up the pieces of someone else's life. I more recently, so of course, I learned a ton from AA, so I would strongly encourage anyone who is dealing with addiction, strongly encourage anyone who has a family member that's an addict, get help for yourself. Make sure you're in Al-Anon or even just in the, you know, in the family counseling sector when you're in there in a group setting was very therapeutic. And to really get out the things that you need to say and have those really hard conversations and have someone who's very qualified and who's just awesome to help you get through that and be honest. But you're going to learn a lot about yourself and a lot about human behavior. And I think that it's so easy for us to judge the addict until you really start to understand brain chemistry, how it's in the DNA, and how it, when someone's using, it changes their brain chemistry. I always tease them. I say, well, of course you're struggling with that. You have brain damage, which is not nice, but it's true. I'm sorry, but it's true. And you, and I tease them all the time. They're like, you're probably right. I mean, you know,
your
so, I mean, it's when you're actively using, it takes two full years for your brain to heal. It takes 2 years for your brain to heal, which is why people relapse, right? And so having a lot of patience is really hard, but you also have to protect yourself and set boundaries and realize that their problems can't be your own. And if it continues and when they're not seeking help, you do have to set that boundary to protect yourself. And I've definitely done that. And I have separated myself from my family when I needed to and to protect my children. So really understand and learn how to set boundaries and also educate yourself about what drug addiction does to the body and to the brain, because it will give you a little more patience with them. I highly recommend the show on Hulu called Dope Sick. It was mind-blowing for me and mind-opening because I really understood what was happening to these people and with these chemicals and what it was doing to their brain and how they... You just tell them, you just quit. It's not that easy. So, yeah, just get really good help.
Isn't it weird how, like, I grew up in a similar, whatever, home. And
it's so hard to talk about. Like, you feel like you're broaching their confidence, even though I've talked. I mean, it is, right? It's
yes. Like,
oh, my God.
And
it's stressful.
Three
I'm sweating.
Out of four of my siblings are not with us anymore.
Due to that?
For sure, one. The other one, and then one sister, I think she lost her life because of COVID. I don't know if you know that. when it first came out. But I think her past drug addiction and use, heavy, attributed to where she was in her 60s.
Right.
And yeah. About my other sister was now. But.
Oh my gosh.
I got some stories, but I was just going to say, I'm listening to your stories and I'm just going through my own childhood, my own. And I just remember like little things that would like put you like, you'd see something, smell something, something would happen. And you all of a sudden you're like, oh, you just tense up like, oh, here we go again. Mm-hmm. And I'm not even joking. For the longest times it was weekends for me.
Okay.
Every weekend as for when I was a kid, because somebody was having a party, somebody's getting drunk, somebody's getting arrested. Somebody's like something. No matter who it was in my family, every weekend, every holiday, every vacation, like a spring break, it was just, here we go again. That's how I grew up every day.
So what would happen at those parties? Because obviously it wasn't a happy party.
No, well, no, it wasn't like they had a party at the house. They would go out partying on a weekend.
And then come home. And
cause a fight. They'd get arrested or... I could tell you all kinds of stories. I remember the first time I pulled a knife on somebody.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
Oh.
I was 9 years old, and my sister's husband, I don't know what happened. My mom, my sister, and him were sitting around the table. I was sitting there, too. It was a Friday evening. Again, weekend.
Weekend.
And they were just talking. I don't remember what we're talking about. And my mom grabbed him or something, his arm, and he grabbed her wrist. And my mom was a tiny little thing. But you didn't mess with her because she was just mean. And not mean, mm-hmm. but she was just like, you didn't mess with her.
Feisty.
Yeah, feisty. And yep. So I don't know what happened, but he twisted her arm. And you could tell she was in pain, but her face was just like staring him in the eye like, I'm not letting you go. And he was just like, let me go, let me go. And I, fight or flight, I'm like, I'm protecting my mom.
For sure.
And there was a knife in the sink, and I grabbed it and I put it up to his throat. I said, you let my mom go or I'm going to kill you.
At 9 years old.
Yeah. And I just, nobody ever taught me that. I didn't know what to do.
Right.
Just, yeah. Ah.
I've had that too. Oh, I've stood outside my mom's bedroom door with a knife waiting to kill my stepdad if he laid a hand on her in a very horrible alcohol. Yeah. So I went from living through that with my mom. And with my mom, there wasn't a ton with the drugs. It was more with the neglect on my end because there was other things that were more important. With my sister, it's been more about fear for her life and then dealing with the ramifications of things. And then into my high school years, living with an abusive alcoholic and the volatility every day, the fighting, the screaming, the cursing, the fear, the instability. Making yourself smaller. You're just...
You try just to not exist.
Mm-hmm. Because if you try to intervene, it only made it worse, and it was bad. And then it's worse on your mom.
Yep.
So, it took me a long time to grow a backbone. I had made myself very small and just... So I was very passive and very weak. So I'm so blessed to have had the people in my life that I've had and that have... And for me, an education is what really saved me. And I do have to... give a shout out to my stepmother, Sally, because she showed me what it was to be the mother and the wife that I am today and to include your kids and to make them part of your life. And she helped make me into the person that I am today after going through all that stuff. You know, when you really weren't in this warm, loving childhood or, you know, 0 to 10 was great. Let's just be clear on that. I don't think I would be who I am today if it wasn't from 0 to 10 was fairly normal.
That's
it was
the molding stages.
Yeah.
That's when
you mold the children. It was when the parents got divorced, everything went to shit. So,
I didn't grow up in a home like that. Like, I mean, I hear stories and it really makes me count my blessings on the home that I was raised in, because my parents are not divorced. They celebrate 50 years this year. I have 3 older brothers, and so we didn't have any of that. My experience came after marriage and after the first back surgery, and it was chronic pain, and then it just went downhill to the point where I can't sleep. Now we're going to incorporate some Ambien. He would do crazy shit on Ambien for the longest time.
Have you ever Googled?
Oh, yes.
You watch those videos online of people?
Yes.
It's crazy.
It is. And I did not do it until after I had, I knew that I had to leave, and that was what was best for my kids. It was the hardest thing that I ever, to pull out of that marriage, but I knew that it was, I would end up dead. He got on Ambien one time and told me that if I ever came up missing, my family would never find me. And then had the audacity to tell me what he would do with me.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. And then there was, I can count.
But there were other meds in his system as well.
Oh, for sure.
He was on so many.
Yes. And then there was
drugs.
There, I mean, for probably the first, probably 3 years out of that marriage, I would wake up with nightmares of pillows coming towards my face because he would roll over in the middle of the night and try to suffocate me. And it, like, it was nuts, right? And then the next morning, I'd be all pissed off, like, what are you doing? You know, and he'd be like, I don't even know what you're talking about. And then anytime you tried to have the conversation with him, like, this is a problem, a big problem, it was, no, no, it's not. And so story after story after story led me to take your kids and run, right? And so that's what I did. But I, but right up till the very end, a year before my ex-husband passed away, I had, my kids had an experience with him where he literally almost killed them. He drove off the road with them at 80 miles an hour into the median. And luckily he didn't roll the car. He didn't, he got back on the freeway.
He fell asleep at the wheel.
Whatever he did.
Yeah, whatever. Passed out, whatever.
He got back on the freeway and said, do not tell your mom. And my kids were so scared that, I mean, I could just tell the actions, all of that. They were, they got in the car, they hugged me there, and they didn't tell me for like a month. But then when your kids are saying, dad has needles in the fridge, dad, okay, we got it. Wow. We have a big issue. We have a really big issue. So I had to have that conversation with him, like, you know, after 17 years of 10 years of marriage and divorce and sharing children and all of that, like, I still, to the bitter end, was like, let me help you. Nobody understands the situation more than I do, all right? Let me help you. Just recognize that there is an issue and it's getting bad. Mm-hmm. And no, 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 I was every word under the sun. And I thought, okay, I'm a big fat bitch. I'm a big fat bitch. Okay.
This is crazy.
So then I just said, you've got, here's your ultimatum. You can go and never look back. But I will not let you be around these kids. I will not, you know, whatever. And so from that point forward, I had a tough conversation with my kids. Like, dad is not in a good state of mind. If something doesn't change, I'm going to get a phone call one day. And I asked them, what do you want me to do if that phone call comes? And both of them were, you know, they gave their feedback because it hadn't happened. It wasn't reality. But the day that phone call came, it was not my, I mean, my whole body was numb. I couldn't feel my hands. That was the toughest conversation I've ever had to have with my kids. And to watch their little bodies go numb. And they're looking to me like, mom, what do we do next? What's our next move? And me, I'm like, shit, I don't know what our next move is. We just drive. We'll just think about it for the next 5 miles. Well, you know, and it just, but with all that, that ugly picture that I just painted, there truly was a rainbow at the end of that story. You know, he's not suffering anymore. It's really sad and unfortunate that addiction took his life. And it's really sad and unfortunate that myself and my kids had a front row seat of that and we couldn't help him. But he's not suffering anymore. You know, the kids aren't scared, and we can be very grateful that he is in a much better place. And so if we look at, you know, I've even pulled out pictures that's been like, you know, this is when your dad and I, we were happy. And my kids never saw that side. They always just saw the ugly side. And so addiction is, it is real. It is, it hurts so many people around you and that person. And, you know, I don't know what takes a person to that point, but I know that it affects everyone and it's hard.
You know, you talked about fear a little while ago when you were talking about fear and you talk about addiction, and I always, to me, they were always hand in hand. I was the youngest of five on my dad, on my mom's side. I have a dad's side too, but I was the youngest of five, and I grew up with my mom and my siblings on my mom's side. And I was always afraid of becoming an addict.
Oh.
Because of what I saw.
Okay.
Like, always afraid.
That was going to be my next question.
Oh, yeah. So I'm going to be, you know, funny. Like, I grew up around all kinds of crazy stuff. But I don't think I smoked pot until I was like 17 or 18, maybe 18, my senior year. And I went to my sister to get it, that she was a dealer. I went on more drug buys when I was a little kid. Anyway.
It's trippy, isn't it? Yeah,
because I was afraid of becoming addicted. And You know, we all talk about that Reefer Madness video when we were, I'm a little bit older than you guys.
Probably not much by me. No. I'm 48. So
I'm the same age. They had this Reefer Madness thing. It was like a black, if you Google it, you can still find it. And it was like, you know, if you smoke marijuana cigarettes, you're going to get addicted.
Oh.
Right? So I saw that in like sixth grade.
Okay.
And I've been around it. I could never tell any of my friends that my, you know, everybody was around me was smoking or whatever. And my mom never did, by the way. Anyway.
Okay.
But my siblings, all my siblings were that way. And I just remember being afraid I was going to get addicted to pot.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily I didn't, but you know, I was the fear.
Yeah.
The fear.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm not doing that.
So for me, because I was alone a lot, I don't know where my sister was. She must have been working. So I was 11 and we were in like low income apartments. My mom would go to work and work like graveyard shifts at a mill, and I was alone. And the kids that could, I would call my friends, and I would be scared to be home alone. And I had friends that maybe their parents weren't as involved, and so often those are the kids, maybe a little sketchier home life. They could sneak out and come hang out with me because I was didn't want to be alone. And those are the people that I would hang around with. So then I was drunk the first time in my life when I was 11.
Your from face.
It was my friend's brother that got alcohol and gave it to us. That was my first. And then I was 11 when I started smoking marijuana. Because the kids that I was around, I know, the kids that I
was Mormon.
I know. The kids I was around maybe didn't have the best home life, and I didn't have any supervision. We were little street rats. We went all over town. We would steal. And like, I think about that 11-year-old kid, and it boggles my mind when I look at my children, because they're so flippin', you know, adored and taken care of. And thank God
they don't even realize it.
They don't. Yeah. Yeah. And so it's just unfathomable to me as a mother to imagine that I was just running around.
It was a different time. It really was. It was a different time.
But
we grew up differently.
I know. It was very different. But yeah, we were, yeah. So luckily, you know, I got out of that environment and went and lived with my dad and my stepmom, and that's what saved my life, because who knows where. And actually, the girl that was my best friend became a heroin addict, and she ended up having to help prosecute a ring of men that were exploiting children with pornography, baiting them with drugs,
dang,
and videotaping them. And that was my best friend. So that's where I was headed.
Dang.
Ugh. And my stepmom saved my life, and my dad. So I don't know what would have happened. You know what I mean? And I don't want, it's so hard because I don't want this judgment on my mom. You know what I mean? But at the same, she just didn't have the skills. She didn't. And she admitted later in life, I probably should not have had kids. You're not my focus.
But you know what? Bless her heart for even acknowledging
that.
Yeah,
it took a long time. But then, but now we have the relationship we do because she finally could.
Well, and it's better. Yeah. But, you know, so through everything, one thing that, I mean, because it's like you said, we live in a completely different day and age. And addiction doesn't just come in substance abuse. It comes in pornography. It comes with overeating. It comes with, I mean, overexertion with exercise. Like, that's not me, by the way.
I know.
1 hour a day. But it does come in all forms. Anytime there's addiction in the equation, it's an imbalance in yourself. I'm no counselor, but I don't think it's rocket science to be like, I do this too much, or you're craving this, because that's truly what addiction is. I think you're chasing the next level of high. And, you know, I noticed with my ex-husband, I didn't know this until after he passed away, but he was shooting up heroin. And some of the things the kids would come home and say was, you know, dad's got needles in his fridge. Dad injected here. And he just said it's what he needs to relax and calm down. Well, I remember when my youngest, you know, he's freaking 9 years old at the time, tells me this. And I'm like, yeah, that doesn't work for your mom. That really doesn't work for me. And you're not in a safe environment anymore. And so when I hit my ex-husband up about that, this is what you're doing in front of him. Do you understand that you're on a a downhill slope. It was, I don't know what I'm talking about. It's, I inject testosterone. You're 41 years old. Come on. What do you need testosterone for? You know, mm-hmm. but it was, I mean, the color of his skin changed, and it was a sad, sad process to watch. And, you know, I always say I had a front row seat that I didn't ask for. And it was an awful, awful process to watch happen. Not good.
That's crazy. I have been doing real estate for 22 years. But I did law enforcement before that for 10 years. And I worked in the prison the whole time. And then I worked on being a parole hearing officer, having hearings of with people who are getting out or up for parole. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I always saw the after effects of addiction. Like, I always said, it's not easy to go to prison. People have to reoffend, and everybody's bailing them out, and judges are giving them chances, and my family included in the town that we grew in. I mean, I'm not sure why they weren't in prison years before one of them was, and the other one was an officer. Like, I don't understand. Anyway, mm-hmm. But I always saw these guys in prison sober, finally, mm-hmm. and to hear them go like, I threw everything away and all the regret. There's some still in denial, but mm-hmm. there was a lot of like, I can't believe where I'm at. Mm-hmm. And then I reflect on my own childhood, like, well, I kind of saw it coming, right? You could see this coming.
Yeah.
And then when I was a parole hearing officer, you'd see like these people in and out of prison or in prison, but they're really like, this is not for me. I'm getting out, right? And I don't know how to say it. I still have friends that do it that are hearing officers, and I don't envy it in any way, shape, or form. But people said, how did you do that? I'm like, you do enough hearings, you see enough people, they kind of have a common theme that you can kind of see it, what they're doing and how their family reacts. And there's ones that are like, their family's enabling them. Like, you're going to go out and fail. I can already tell you, right?
Back.
It's just crazy. But you just have I've seen all of it, just like you. You've seen the during, the before, during, and after. Mm-hmm. And it's devastating. Mm-hmm.
Do you think being on was it the parole board?
It was the parole commission. Okay. I wasn't on the commission. I was a hearing officer.
Okay. So do you think being on that, like, I mean, you could totally tell which ones were, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell a con artist? Where they get in front of you and they're like, you know. Talking,
I think,
some serious
fluff. Oh, I think so. Yeah. Yeah. So like, you know, actions, words, actions and words, they go a long ways. If you do it enough hearings, you can kind of see all these people, right?
Right.
Cause if I was looking back, if I was in prison and I said, I'm going to do all these things to get out of prison, but I'm going to have all the same friends, I'm going to go back.
You're right. Going to go back to the default,
right.
For
right.
sure.
So I know, I remember when I worked next across from an offender, or next to an offender, I worked at three different prisons, not once, maybe once, but not once. I would say once, maybe. I never looked in their central files because an officer told me a long time ago, hey, look, man, don't read their files. Mm-hmm. You can. He said, I said, why? He says, then you won't be able to treat them like a human being. Mm-mm.
Wow.
And I'm like, okay. But when I went to the parole hearing, when I was a hearing officer, you had to read their files. You had to go interview the victims. You had to, like, the whole nine yards, their family, their parole plan, the whole. And that was the real ugly side of the world.
Wow.
Pre-sentence investigators do it all the time, every day, before somebody goes to prison. They have to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm. So this is totally in a different direction, but I have always heard that sex offenders, you can't rehabilitate them. Is that true?
I don't know. I'm not a psychologist, professional.
They say that if they get out, they're going to offend again.
Here's what I say. This is what I used to, this is my line. I got lots of lines. At whose safety do you want to take that chance?
You don't.
Mm-hmm. Is it yours? Right. Your kids? Mm-hmm. Yours?
No.
See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So if like, there's no proven track record, or there's no, like, I don't.
So that's who makes that call?
The parole commission has a. There was five at the time.
Okay.
You've seen a parole hearing in the movies,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, but I don't story it's Hollywood.
Different. It's different.
I know, but they're there and they listen and they have, do feel rehabilitated and blah blah blah, and they tell them what they've been doing. I'm taking college courses. I'm doing this. I'm doing that.
Okay, so here's how it really works.
So how does it
so
really
we
work?
Do all the hearing officers does do all the investigations, read all the prior reports, all the current reports, all their stuff. And there's some factors they can take into consideration, and then they write a report. Sometimes it's 15 pages, sometimes it's 30. But they've got everything that they can find, dig up, and they hear, and they make it into a report with a summary at the end. And the summary says, based on the summary, here's what I recommend. Mm. And there's five different people reading the same recommendation. Then they hear all these people come in and say, please let my Johnny out, or my Susie. I did female hearings all over the country also. Please, and we're going to take care. And sometimes it's too much, right? And you're like, And then you read where that person turned their blind eye to them 5 years ago, to them abusing somebody or something, or allowing something to happen. And now we're going to put you back in their care?
Yeah.
Okay, but, you know.
You have to look at the big picture.
You have to look at the big picture, right? It's all about dollars and cents. Who's, there's so many factors, but.
Mm-hmm. Ugh.
Yeah, I was 26 years old when I started doing this. 26 crazy. Years old, 26 to 30, and I'm like,
and you're seeing this whole other world.
Yeah. I can see why there.
Oh,
was
I was
a
20 when I started
change.
The prison. I was 20 when I started the prison, 30 when I got out, and people are like, why? And I'm like, I like people. I was just working with the wrong ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
I like real estate.
Jaded, becoming hardened. Yeah, that's what happens, man.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh,
it's a crazy world. It's a crazy world. And there's so many factors that contribute to someone becoming addicted, whether they have a familial history, whether they have that in their DNA, which they're learning more that it really is in the DNA. So some people, they don't even want to roll the dice. If you even try it, you know, it could go sideways. Like with my sister, there's a lot of recreational use and no, like, for years, recreational. Nothing ever locked her in. But there was one that she tried that locked her in, and that was the end of it. And it went downhill from there. And you know, what you learn when you're looking at the science of it is there's so much that's in their brain that is different. They're wired differently, the addict's brain. And so you can be a dry drunk. You can be, you know, because they still have those behaviors. And so that's why it's really good to get an education if you're dealing with that with your family, because you'll understand how to set boundaries. You'll understand what they're going through, because they're not. And then also, like I said, educate yourself to understand that when someone's just coming off of those, you know, those drugs, whether it's drugs or alcohol, I don't know necessarily with alcohol. I know that there's going to be more internal damage, you know, to the
my brother told me
one
time
alcohol.
My brother told me one time, he says, I don't know who I'd be if I didn't drink. He right. drank oh. so long.
Yeah. He totally, that was part of his identity.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the brain changes with alcohol as well. And I know for sure with drugs, once you come off of those, you have to heal for 2 years. And so that's why people reoffend, because literally they have brain damage. And so you have to, I can't even imagine. For me, I can't imagine my body going through that. Like, I can't imagine, because they're probably pissed at themselves too for relapsing, and they don't even know why. And they just don't want to be sick. And it's sad and frustrating, and it's just awful that it's not even just street drugs that we have to worry about. It's prescription drugs as well, and yeah. It's such a warped system. But you just have to learn how to set boundaries, how to protect yourself, and learn what they're going through. Learn, just educate yourself. That's the best thing that you can do, because you'll understand human behavior and why they're doing the things that they're doing, and then how you can protect yourself in those situations by setting boundaries of what you'll tolerate and what you won't.
Yeah.
You know, and I definitely did that. And I was like, you're not seeing my children.
Yeah.
You're not yourself. Yeah. Sorry. And those are hard conversations.
Well,
I've dealt with friends that didn't want to do it. I'm like, you have to save yourself, because, you know, they were letting their family members watch their kids. No, because they felt guilty. I'm like, No. You can't put your child at risk because you feel guilty. Like, you have to set that boundary and protect yourself.
So where it was in your family, you said you had that fear that you would become addicted.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so I mean, obviously, maybe genetic because your whole family's doing it, right? Yours no different, you know, a little on the genetic side.
Well, I will say, I was going to say this. Back when I was on the parole commission, you see, there's no good cases. They're all just tragic.
You're in prison.
Yeah. But I used to say addiction doesn't discriminate. It doesn't care if you're what color you are. It doesn't care if you're family history or not. They don't. If you're super religious or not religious, it doesn't discriminate.
Yeah. Yeah.
I always had a healthy fear. I remember, I said I was smoking marijuana when I was 11. I remember being middle school.
I just can't joint at 11.
There's so many people in this world that
I know. Are you even in puberty yet?
No. I was 15 when that happened.
You're token.
So,
no.
So we were at school, up on the top of this little hill, smoking our weed. And someone was like, offered me hash. And I was like, oh, that's drugs.
Does that come with eggs? That's what I would say.
I know, right? With eggs? And I was like, and it was like, it looked different. And I was like, no. Like, that to me was drugs. Weed was like a plant. You know what I mean? Like, it is very different now than it was back then. It was just probably the trashiest stuff ever. Anyway, who knows? But I remember thinking, that is a drug, and it scared the shit out of me. Yeah. And I did not want anything to do with the drug. And I always had a very healthy fear. And with my kids, I try to instill that fear in them, you know, show them as much as I can of what has gone in their family. We have another family member that has could have lost his life from addiction, was an athlete and a college athlete and a brilliant young man with a very bright future, and was prescribed medication to treat all of his injuries as an athlete, and his physician was giving him 100 at a time. And this was a defrauding of the medical, you know, the doctors had no idea what they were prescribing because they were lied to. This is OxyContin. And the people are told, this is not even addictive, you're fine. But the body knows the reality of it until you become more. And if you stop taking it, you know, he got to the point where he wasn't even high anymore. He's like, I don't feel it. I just don't want to be sick. They feel like they're going to die. And so they steal, and they don't even remember. They don't even know who they are because their brain is so damaged from these chemicals. And so, you know, you're frustrated and pissed and trying to hold them accountable, but it's so sad to know that they're a victim as well. You know what I mean? And like you said, you don't know if it's going to happen to you or not. For me, I've taken pain pills and I'm like, okay, I'm good. You know, I can just stop. Thank God.
I don't know if you were talking about this or not, but I recently had a very long medical stay challenge, blah, blah, blah. We don't have to go into that. But
let's talk about it.
Hold on.
Okay.
This healthy fear still. Again, I am 48 years old, okay? Mm-hmm. And I was in the hospital last year for a couple months. And in a lot of, when I woke up, I was in a lot of pain. Mm-hmm. And I was fearful that it's never going to go away.
Because you were intubated.
I was intubated, yeah.
And were you kept in a medical coma?
Yes. Okay. But when they turn you, it's not. They have explained it that it's not pretty. It's not. I mean, you're basically, I was 200 pounds and lifeless, right?
Sure.
Just, right. So. I came up hurting everywhere, and sure. I thought there's some lifelong, I'm never going to heal from this, my shoulder and my neck, and anyway. And they were giving me some pain pills. Well, I was on so much pain medication, they were fearful that they gave me too much.
Sure.
Oh, wow.
I finally came out. That's why they call me like...
The walking miracle.
Yeah. I don't know. Anyway, yeah. And I...
Oh, they OD'd you out by accident one time.
No, I don't know.
Oh, I thought you were saying
No, like, I don't know. Like, don't tell me that. How do you know?
No, you said they gave me too much.
No, they gave me too much. I've been told they gave me too much. They were fearful that they gave me too much to bring me out.
That's what I meant. Oh, yes. Okay. That's what I was. They overdosed you unintentionally.
Right, because I guess I'm a little feisty anyway.
Sure.
And so when I would hear a voice or feel a touch from my lady, that I would, you know.
Respond.
Yeah. And
they needed you more subdued.
Yes. So they'd give me more and more and more. So.
Sure.
But even when I came out, I heard everywhere. And even before I got out of the hospital, I was weaning myself off of medication because I was fearful I was going to get addicted to prescription drugs. I was
like, mm-hmm. It's very real. It's very real, you know, physiologically. And I remember I had foot surgery and I was taking pain medication and I wanted to wean myself off because I didn't want to have a dependency. And my physician said, you will take this medication. Because I literally took it for like 2 days. And I was like, I'm good. And he said, no, I need you to take a little bit longer because you won't heal properly if you're having chronic pain. And I didn't even think about the whole cortisol response and everything like that, that you actually do inhibit your healing when you're actively in pain because of the stress response and everything like that. So I was very cautious, though.
Yeah.
You know, I was very cautious. And luckily, a lot of them, I don't like the way I feel anyway. But yeah, I didn't want to be in pain, but I would definitely like alternate with other medications so that that wasn't my primary source of pain relief. You do need to protect yourself. You need to be very self-aware and notice if you don't want that feeling to be appealing. And if you're having any sort of side effects in between doses, you need to listen to your body.
Yeah. Well, I don't understand it because any type of Percocet, Oxycontin, Lortab, any of that makes you constipated. You can't poop. Right? Even with the stool softener.
What it does is with addicts, for some addicts that I've spoken to, it would often have the opposite effect on them.
Oh.
When they would shoot up, everything would come out.
Yeah, I have no idea.
Yeah, so that's not necessarily a thing with everybody.
Oh.
And I just learned that not long ago.
Because one of the side effects, they've always said, it constipates you.
Oh
and
my
I'm
God.
Like, gosh,
horribly.
You'd just be so uncomfortable from that. Why?
Yeah, I'd be grumpy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So apparently that is not always.
Me too.
That doesn't do that to everybody. Isn't that interesting?
I think maybe if you, I don't know. I'm so uneducated on this whole topic. I just feel like I'm not even qualified to talk about it.
Well, you lived it. And that's the, I mean, I think. It's so, you know, in what, you know, with Ashley and I work with the public and we have, you know, we have a lot of one-on-one conversations with these people. And it's so fascinating to me how I bet you every person in my chair has had someone in their life that's dealt with addiction, whether it's their mom, their sister, whatever. And it is a family disease and it does affect everyone. And it's, you know, obviously we know it's a worldwide problem. So
the only time I've ever taken a pain, I'm just thinking about this now. You guys are, can I say what you guys do?
Yeah, dental hygiene. We'll talk about it. Yeah.
Okay, so when I was 20, I got all my four of my guys taken out.
Yeah.
Your third.
Teeth. Yeah.
And I got.
Oh, my guys.
Oh, my guys.
And I don't know what I took, but my daughter's mom was, we were together. She fed me like pain pills for like 2 days or something. Mm-hmm. I didn't wake up for like 2 days. I'm like, what happened? What's going on? And I just remember waking up and having this horse pill shoved down my throat because I was like,
oh, she was doing it for
well,
you.
Well, yeah, because she was it, like, yeah, because I think it was a big baby because I was more than a man cold, I guess, but I don't know.
Oh, wisdom tooth. It's a big deal.
It is a big deal.
I got dry socket, which really
stinks. Oh, that's not good. Did you really?
Oh, yeah, that was bad.
That's bad.
That is bad.
And then I had to put like the tar on the thing and it had to go in every day and they'd pull it out and put more in. I was horrible.
Medication.
It's so clove oil and all that. Yeah. Dry socket paste. It's good for what ails you. It's really stinky. I've had it too. It's yucky.
Yeah. So.
But yeah, you hear a lot about that actually, that some people, their addiction begins after dental procedures. And so our doctors have to be very, you know, cautious as patients come in because you have drug seekers that come in. I heard a funny story. This is so crazy. This person brought in a tooth. Gosh, I think it was one of the doctors that I work for. It was his professor, still practiced. And this guy rolls in. It's always like 3 o'clock on a Friday or whatever, right? They're rolling in. Hey, this guy comes in legit with a tooth in his hand. He was like, my tooth fell out. My mouth hurts. Can you give me some pain pills? This was like clean tooth. It wasn't bloody, nothing. It was a molar. Oh. And he goes, okay, let's have a look in your mouth. There was not one socket anywhere. Like his teeth.
He's like, oh, you're going to look?
Yeah.
Oh.
This guy had been going around to dentists all over and wherever they're at, like handing his stuff. So he took his, he goes, can I see that? And he took it from him. And he's like, well, dude, give me back my tooth. And he was like, no.
It's not yours. It's not.
Wow. Where did you steal this from?
Yeah, he was like, I need my tooth.
Holy cow. Wow.
So yeah, we see some crazy, yeah, so.
You need to swap that for a telephone number down to rehab.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my
goodness.
We're
not stupid. The people that come in and it hurts really bad, and you want to tell them that now. Really? I'll tell you right now, dental pain people, NSAIDs are your friend. You need
who?
Ibuprofen, NSAIDs, non-steroidal.
Like an anti-inflammatory.
So basically you want ibuprofen and you want like Aleve, and you can alternate it with Tylenol, but drugs tell your brain it doesn't hurt, but
it hurts.
Anti-inflammatories actually treat the pain. They actually treat the pain. So you can alternate, but don't just rely on narcotics to relieve dental pain. Side note. Because you're in pain because you're inflamed and you need anti-inflammatories.
Get to the root of the problem.
Quit thinking you're going to fool your dentist and get a bunch of pain pills.
Do you think he ordered that tooth off of Amazon or something?
I have no idea.
I think I have my daughter's, all her baby teeth. How much do you think I could sell them for?
Ew.
You have them?
Not a baby
kind
tooth.
Don't give me the ew.
I'm kind
bad.
Of judging you right now. Isn't she like a... Isn't she in her 20s?
She's 22.
Shit.
Well, I think you might be in a bag. Well, I don't collect much at all. Like, I'm a real minimalist. But I think I was like, oh.
You're the freaking tooth fairy.
Where's your wings? Where's your wings, Rob? Got pink wings.
Okay. Judging right
TMI,
now.
TMI, guys. Sorry.
I love it. And it's so funny, me being in dentistry, you too, Ash. I'm like, they're like, what do you want me to do with this tooth when they're older? I'm like, do whatever you want with it. I don't want it. I think maybe I see enough teeth. I'm like, I'm good.
Do you know, when my kids figured out the whole tooth fairy thing, I remember the orthodontist told Bowen, hey, you need to get rid of these before we can move forward with braces. So we're out for a family walk, and I mean, he's on it. He's ripping them out. By the time the walk's over, he's got two of them out.
Dang.
And do you know what? I'm so proud of him. He ripped it out, throws it down in the gutter, like down in like the little, where the water goes, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then he goes, hey, Mom, you just want to transfer some money to my account?
How much they give now?
Inflation.
Yeah, right? Yeah. How much?
Like $5 or something. It depends on the kid. Pretty sure I've done $5 on your pillow.
When Cooper pulled a silver tooth, he's like, "This is a $5 tooth," and I was like, "Yes, it is, baby."
That's hilarious.
God,
that's hilarious.
That is too funny.
Oh,
yeah. Holy crap!
Well, we got off topic, but more of the story. Addiction.
Okay, I'm all about solution based. You talked a little about solutions.
Yes.
Right? I'm luckily enough not to have any severe or active addicts in my life.
Mm-hmm. Good.
So what do people do? I've never my brothers, my sisters didn't ever go to AA.
Right. So, I mean, thank goodness for the internet and everything now, but unfortunately there's not a lot available to people that don't have insurance. My sister did go to a program once that was sponsored by the state. It was a bad program. It was bad. It was with homeless people. But I was like, that's where you're staying. Sorry. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like I said, it's really hard not to be critical and to be mean because you do get mad. But also sometimes they have to have that tough love they have to have a little discomfort to want it to be better.
Yeah.
But
I think you have to ask the question first. Do you know you have a problem?
Going to say no.
That is the number one thing.
Ashley's like, duh.
Well, I know with my ex-husband, he was like, yes, I was every name under the sun and I don't have a problem, right?
Oh, yeah.
But for those that truly do recognize that there is a problem, and then just say, is it something you want help with? Because if they don't want help, there's nothing you can do. Well, I mean, even with unconditional love, there isn't.
Well, I think you hit it on the head earlier when you said there's no real program. So you almost have to go to prison or to drug court. I don't know if you guys know what drug court is. So I like, anyway. So you have to go with one of those two. Otherwise, have insurance that covers it and also have a job that's going to let you off for 3 months or 30 days. I don't know how long the programs are, but you know what I'm saying?
Right.
That just doesn't happen. So you almost have to go to prison or jail to get severe, you know?
To clean up where you don't have access to
it. Yeah, but unfortunately, there's drugs in our jails. There's They can get anything that they need. I mean, they really, it's not a place to get sober, unfortunately. And so.
They now have facilities that are, like, I think Idaho has one or two, for sure, out south of Boise.
Right.
That are just, like, specific for drug rehab. Incarceration also, but it's good. It's come a long ways.
That's really good.
But you
to
have
hear
to go to prison.
You do. But then you think about it. For those people that go in for 30 days or even 90 days, they get out. And if it takes 2 years for your brain to heal, what's going to happen between that 90 days and that 2 years? Because you're not going to go. It has to be that person's decision at that point. And it literally. So, like, I struggle with my weight right now, and I definitely have food addiction issues. I definitely struggle with that and have, and I think that it's my comfort. And after just, it's a long story, but I've definitely used it for comfort for a long time and coping skills. And it is something that you have to talk to yourself about every single day and all day long. And I know with addicts, there is a lot they have to regulate all the time. That's why you have to work a program while you still have to keep going, because the things that you learn about communication and human behavior and even just your own BS that the addict mind goes to, if you don't continue to work those steps, if you don't continue to have those teachings in the forefront of your mind, they go out the window. So you're constantly having to educate yourself and remind yourself, and it takes a lot of work and a lot of effort.
Oh, it's discipline.
I got eating issues too. Don't feel bad.
It's terrible.
I'm hungry. I haven't eaten today.
Uh-oh, that's not good. A little bit of fasting.
Cheesecake, anyone? Cheesecake? Yeah,
you know, when I was in the hospital, I just got to say, when I went to the hospital, I lost 40 pounds.
Wow.
Yeah, in like 2 months. It was crazy.
Oh, wow. Well, yeah, because your picture on Facebook or whatever, that you sent like a picture of him, and you don't look like that person.
Yeah, I walked out of the hospital. I was like, I'm walking out of this SOB.
But the first time I saw you after you got out of the hospital, I mean, I could definitely tell. Like, you were thinned out.
I was 180 pounds. Nice. And I looked like I was, So
check me out.
So check this out. I lost all this weight, and the only place I didn't lose weight on is the same thing I've had my entire life, this spare tire.
Oh.
And I'm like, really? Can that just go away?
Why didn't you roll me to that side?
Right?
And I lay on my side.
Damn nurses didn't do their job.
Yeah, but I gained it all back plus some, so life is good. Well, I did, I promise.
But I think you look so much healthier and so good now.
I'm happy to be
and
alive.
I'm very glad that
I really like, oh my God, thank you for every moment.
You were
you know?
Self-aware enough to recognize what you needed to do to take care of yourself. And I think having that self-awareness going into a medical situation, if you know you're going to needing pain medication, make yourself aware of the signs of potential dependence. Just really be aware of what that can do to your body. And then of course how detrimental it can be on your life and how long it takes to recover from that. Yeah. Obviously your situation, you didn't know you were going to be into the hospital and be intubated, but for your family members, if something happens, watch them, be cautious. I think knowledge is power. Educate yourself as much as you can. For parents, talk to your resource officers. Know what's going on in your kid's life. Snoop through their phone. You know, let them know that you're there for them. And because unfortunately, it's in our school systems a lot, and more so than we know in Idaho. Talk to police officers. Talk to law enforcement, because there's a lot that we don't know that's going on out there. So, just educate yourself in all these areas so that you can protect yourself and your family.
Yeah,
copy.
Great.
So,
copy.
Yeah. Well, on that note, let's wrap it up. Robert,
seems terrible to say cheers after this addiction or after this addition.
You know what? Cheers to life.
Cheers to life.
We are happy to be alive.
Yes,
and
ma'am.
Cheers.
I'm actually sober today.
That's funny.
So that's good.
You're stupid.
I'm actually sober.
All right, we're out.
But I'm raising my glass.